This is Phil Farron. And I am driving home. It's Thursday today. I have tomorrow off unless something goes wrong. And Monday is Martin Luther King Day. So I'm not coming in on Monday, which means I have 4 days to write. And while it would be optimistic of me to say that I'm going to get the next book roughed in, at the end of those 4 days, I should be close. I hope to be close. And I hope to have a good epilogue. That's the big challenge now. I've got to land the epilogue. I still have to actually finish up the book, but I'm really close on the book. I have a little tweaking to do. I thought I was going one direction on the book, and then the more I thought about it, the more I realized it wasn't really true to the character, and so I got to back up a little bit. But I was laying in bed this morning before I actually got out of bed, and I was just running all the possibilities, and so I think I know how to get that wrapped out. The book is actually ending. It's actually ending a bit more dramatic than I originally intended, but drama is a good thing. So I have a buddy that when he reads this book, he's going to say, "Yeah, well, there's your Empire Strikes Back book." Because there is a standard thing that you do with trilogies. You know, you have the first one, it's self-contained, ends on a kind of a high note. Do the second one. Sorry. You do the second one. That one always ends with everything in peril. And then, of course, in the third one, ta-da, you come back. And so it's the whole A New Hope from Star Wars, and then The Empire Strikes Back, and then Revenge of the Jedi, Return of the Jedi. So, you know, whenever I do something that has that pattern in it, then when he beta reads, he always comes back out and says, "Well, there's your Empire Strikes Back." So, and you know who you are, Darren. So, anyways, but I'm hoping that we'll get this closed up. If not this weekend, this next week. And then I have to do a full read-through, see where I'm at, see if it feels right, and then I'm probably going to go back and read, at least skim the last one I did, to remind myself of what's there, to kind of stabilize that, and then go back and do another read-through, and hopefully by the time I get the third read-through done, things will be stable enough that I can work on a cover. And we're not going to make February 1st for a beta release. Ain't no way. But, you know, maybe March 1st. Should be March 1st. If I can land the epilogue, March 1st should be well within range. So it's a month longer than it's supposed to be, but then again, the book is a third longer than it's supposed to be, so, oh well. Anyways, this week, good things happening this week. My major client went down to Branson and did a presentation to them, and that all seemed to go fine, and people seem to like what they're seeing, and they're excited about it, so that's all good. Next couple of weeks, we have to get a website ready for the initial deployment to give everybody kind of an inner circle a chance at a first look and to give us some feedback and see what else we need to do before we're ready for a primary release. And then a couple of months, we should be ready for a primary release, limited release, and then let those people shake it out for 3 months or so, fix all the problems there, and then we're planning on doing the big release in summer, middle of summer. So hopefully it's going to be something that'll be useful. Hopefully. meantime, I'll keep working on other things. So anyway, so that's all going well. Already talked about the writing, and my son-in-law and daughter are just going like crazy at this point, which we knew they would as soon as they got, you know, voted in as pastor's praise assembly. So, but that all seems to be going fine as well. And, so it's good. Life goes on. I'm expecting them to kind of, you know, be in the wind here for several months while things settle down. And then once things settle down, I expect to be able to see them some more frequently. Thankfully, we will see them this weekend. Oh, when we have family dinner. So we'll get caught up then and see how everything's going. This week, I went back to a TED Talk that I had heard several weeks ago called The Wonderful and Terrifying Implications That Computers Can Learn. And, oh, if I just had a bit more time, I would actually do some real investigating and playing with what they're talking about in here, because it sounds extremely interesting, but it's just time. I can't write in the evenings and play around with this kind of stuff as well. Although, I'm not really sure I want to play around with this stuff and usher in the apocalypse. So the name of the guy who was doing the talk was Jeremy Howards, and he was going, kind of giving a brief recap of the state of things as they are. And it was fascinating. It was fascinating. We appear to be a little farther along than I thought we would be at this point in terms of impacting society, but nonetheless it appears to be coming, and coming quickly. So he started off, of course, by saying that used to be that in order to get a computer to do something new, you had to program it. So you had to go through and lay out, in his words, excruciating detail, everything you wanted that computer to do, which is true. And then the computer would do it to achieve your goal. With the advent of machine learning, there are different approaches. And he talked about the fact that if you go back to Arthur Samuel in 1956, he wanted to program a computer to play checkers. And he wondered what would be the best way to do this, and he decided, well, maybe we'll just have the computer play itself over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. And then it can learn how to better play checkers. And in fact, that he started in 1956. By 1962, the computer had actually beaten the Connecticut state champion. So, you know, checkers, great. The guy who's giving the talk, Jeremy Howards, went on to say that he's the president of Kaggle, which is a community of over 200,000 machine learning practitioners. At which point I say, stop it! Stop doing that! Stop it! But no one's listening to me, so they're going to keep doing it. And he was saying that he feels like the first really big success of machine learning was Google, because they use apparently machine learning algorithms to figure out how to return search results better. He said at this point, companies like Amazon and Netflix use machine learning to suggest products and, you know, movies that you might want to watch. He said Facebook uses machine learning. So does LinkedIn. And he said all of these people are doing stuff that at times it feels creepy, because it feels like they really know something about you. And obviously, IBM has used machine learning. And one of the things that they did with machine learning was Watson. So Watson was able to defeat quite handily the two best world champions in Jeopardy. And it was answering really incredibly subtle questions. I remember when I was when I was watching it, occasionally Watson would get off, and it would be way off. I mean, it was like, what is blue cheese? It didn't have anything to do with blue cheese. But for the most part, it was hitting home runs. Finding the questions for things like, the ancient Lion of Nimrod went missing from this city's National Museum in 2003, along with a lot of other stuff. And he could actually get that. So he goes on and talks about what's happening in computer learning. And he said one of the most amazing examples that he's seen of machine learning happened on a project that he ran at Kaggle, where a team run on a project, yeah, that is, where a team was run by a guy named Geoffrey Hinton from University in Toronto, and he won a competition for automatic drug discovery. He said, what's extraordinary about this is not only did they beat all the algorithms that were developed by Merrick or the international academic community, said nobody on the team had any background in chemistry or biology or life sciences. And he said they did it in 2 weeks. So within 2 weeks, this team, using machine learning, was able to develop an algorithm for automatic drug discovery that was better than ones that were developed by experts in the field who spent a lot more time on them. And it was all because they used an algorithm called deep learning, is the name of the algorithm. And this is where, you know, if I had some more time, I would actually like to investigate this algorithm and see what they're doing. But who has the time? He went on to say that this fact was so important that it was covered on the New York Times front page in an article a few weeks later. He said, deep learning is an algorithm inspired by how the human brain works. And I think maybe there has been a TED Talk on deep learning. And as a result, it's an algorithm that has no theoretical limitations on what it can do. The more data you give it, the better the more computation time you get it, give it, the better it gets. So they've been using this deep learning algorithm on a bunch of stuff. For instance, they took a large amount of information from many Chinese speakers and produced a text-to-speech system that takes Chinese text and converts it into the Chinese language. And then he said, we took an hour or so of my own voice and used that to modulate the standard text-to-speech system so that it sounds like me. So you type in text, and now it sounds like this guy. There was also a competition in Germany called the German Traffic Sign Recognition Benchmark. And then he showed a picture of the German traffic sign. He said not only could it recognize traffic signs better than any other algorithm, the leaderboard actually showed it was better than people. It was actually about twice as good as people. He said in 2012, he said Google announced that they had a deep learning algorithm, watch YouTube videos, and crunched the data on 16,000 computers for a month. The computer independently learned about concepts such as people and cats just by watching the videos in much the same way humans learn. Because obviously we as humans, we don't learn by being told what we see, by only being told what we see, but we also learn by just watching stuff and picking up stuff. And supposedly this deep learning algorithm can actually do this. He said also in 2012, Geoffrey Hinton, who was the earlier guy with the drug discovery algorithm, won the very popular ImageNet competition looking to try to figure out from 1.5 million videos what they're pictures of. So you just show this picture to the computer and the computer figures out what it's a picture of. He said, as of 2014, we are now down to a 6% error rate in image recognition. This is better than people, again. He said, other people are using it. He said, for example, Google announced last year that they had mapped every single location in France in 2 hours. And the way they did it was that they fed Street View images into a deep learning algorithm to recognize and read street numbers. Now, obviously, if you had to do this with people looking at all those images, it would have taken dozens of people and years. He said Baidu in China, which is kind of Google's, well, Baidu is sort of the Google of China. So Baidu, you can upload a picture to Baidu. It will analyze the picture, and then it will find other pictures that are similar to that picture out on the internet. It'll find, and he said it doesn't do this. He said, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, well, I can type that into Google, and I can get images back. But he said, what Google is actually doing there is they're analyzing the text that are associated with these pictures. What Baidu's algorithm, its deep learning algorithm, is doing is physically analyzing the picture you upload to it, and then it has already physically analyzed all the other pictures that it has access to. And it's looking at those pictures and saying, oh yeah, these have similar elements, and so it's showing them. So, this is pretty scary stuff. he claims that deep learning now, in fact, is near human performance in understanding what sentences are about and what it is saying about those things. So, there are systems now that when you type in an algorithm, or when you just type in a sentence, to a deep learning algorithm, that it can tell what the emotional connotation of the sentence is. He said also deep learning has been used to read Chinese, again at the level of a native Chinese speaker. He said this algorithm was developed out of Switzerland by people none of whom speak or understand Chinese. He claims that using deep learning is about the best system in the world for this, even compared to native human understanding. Then he showed a system that his company put together using deep learning. And what they did is they just had a bunch of pictures. I mean a bunch of pictures. They threw it at, he said, these are pictures that have no text attached, and he says, as I'm typing in sentences in real time, it's understanding these pictures and figuring out what they're about and finding pictures that are similar to the text that I'm typing. So you can see it's actually understanding, he said, as he was showing a video, he said, it was actually understanding his sentences and understanding the pictures. So, he was also talking about the fact that there are algorithms now that can look at pictures and write captions for them. He said, we're not quite at human performance here. He said, but we're close. He said, in tests, humans prefer the computer-generated captions 1 out of 4 times. He said, this system is only 2 weeks old, so probably within the next year, the computer algorithm will be well past human performance at the rate things are going. He said, in addition, a team in Boston announced that they had discovered dozens of new clinically relevant features of tumors which help doctors make a prognosis for cancer. Said, similarly, in Stanford, a group there announced, looking at tissues under magnification, they have developed a machine learning-based system, which in fact is better than human pathologists at predicting survival rates for cancer sufferers. In both of these cases, not only were the predictions more accurate, they also generated new insightful science. In the radiology case, there were new clinical indicators that humans can understand. In the pathology case, the computer system actually discovered that the cells around the cancer are just as important to the cancer cells themselves when making a diagnosis. Machine learning. And he goes on and on. He was saying how the using this deep learning algorithm, which was built entirely, again, by people with no medical expertise. He said, similarly, here is neuron segmentation. We can now segment neurons about as accurately as humans can. And I think what that means is when they go in, they look at slides, they pull apart neurons and figure out what pieces belong to what. But this system was developed with deep learning using people with no previous background in medicine. So the theme here over and over again is that you can actually do stuff with this algorithm if you understand the algorithm, not needing the expert knowledge necessarily of the field you're trying to do something with, which is really fascinating. That's really, really fascinating. I wish somebody would take this deep learning and apply it to listening to like an orchestra and then scoring out all the parts. That would be cool. That would be very, very cool. He talked about the fact that they're in the process of developing. He said, I think this is where he was talking about the fact that, you know, since he doesn't know anything about medical science either, he figured, why shouldn't he develop some medical algorithm? And it has to do with diagnosis. And he said it now takes us about 15 minutes to generate a new medical diagnostic test. And he said, I'll show you that in real time, but I've compressed it down to 3 minutes by cutting out some of the pieces. Rather than showing you creating a medical diagnostic test, I'm going to show you a diagnostic test of car images, because that's something we can all understand. So, in other words, what he's going to do is he's going to have this deep learning algorithm figure out what it's looking at and figure out how to classify stuff that it's looking at. And what he did was he showed video. He said normally it takes about 15 minutes, but he showed video of, I think he said, 1.5 million car images. They just took these 1.5 million images and just threw it at the machine. And the machine starts looking through them and starts figuring out different shapes and boundaries and that kind of stuff. And he said it starts organizing them to where, is this a side view? Is it a front view? Is it a back view? You know, blah, 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 blah. You start putting labels. Oh, that's the back view. This is the front view. Occasionally, the computer is going to start getting confused because it has a hard time, you know, figuring out what is left and what is right view because they're similar. What is front and what is back? And so then you just go in and give it examples. Say, no, that's left. This is right. This is front. This is back. The computer then uses that, figures out why those things are different, recategorizes everything. And he said this process takes about 4 or 5 iterations. And you can say, you know, we're up to about 62% of our 1.5 million images classified correctly. And he showed how they got to 80, and then he showed by 15 minutes, they were able to get to 97% classification rates. Now then, so what? He said, well, for instance, he said the World Economic Forum says that there's between a 10 times and 20 times shortage of physicians in the developing world, and it would take 300 years to train enough people to fix the problem. Well, he said, imagine if we could make diagnosis using these deep learning things and screen through a bunch of these people. I'm assuming this is what they'd do. Sorry, it's been a long week. Screen through a bunch of people and get preliminary diagnosis for them to where the doctors could concentrate on stuff that really needed their expertise. So as exciting as all those opportunities are, which I'm not sure how exciting they are, but he, you know, did get down to the meat of it, for me at least, when he said, I'm also concerned about the problems. He said, the problem here is that every area in this blue map, and basically it's all the industrialized world. We're talking United States, Canada, Europe, Russia, Australia, you know, Brazil, all those areas. He said, all those areas have services that are over 80% of employment. He said, what are services? These are services. There are also things that we expect computers to do. So a lot of this stuff that is in the service industry, we expect computers to do eventually. He said, so 80% of the world's employment in the developed world is stuff that computers are learning, well, he says, have learned to do. He said, well, what does that mean? Well, it'll be fine, he said, some people say. They'll be replaced by other jobs. For example, there will be more jobs for data scientists. And he said, well, not really. He said, it doesn't take data scientists very long to build these things. He said, for example, these four algorithms that he mentions were all built by the same guy. So if you think, oh, it's all happened before, we've seen the results in the past, and when new things come along, they'll get replaced by new jobs. Well, what are these new jobs going to be? He said, it's very hard for us to estimate this. So because human performance grows at this gradual rate, but we now have a system, deep learning, that we know actually grows in capability exponentially. And we're here. So currently we see things around us and we say, oh, computers are still pretty dumb, right? But in five years' time, computers will be off the chart. Said, so we need to start thinking about this capability now. Said, the machine learning revolution is going to be very different from the industrial revolution because the machine revolution never settles down. The better computers get at intellectual activities, the more they can build better computers to be better at intellectual capabilities. So this is going to be a kind of change where the world has never actually experienced before, so your previous understanding of what's possible is different. Okay, if these guys actually let computers design their successors without putting in any kind of filters on that, Skynet is coming. I'm just telling you, Skynet is coming. He said, he concluded by saying, computers right now can do things that humans spend most of their time being paid to do. So now's the time to start thinking about how we are going to adjust our social structures and economic structures to be aware of this new reality. Okay, yeah. The question is, humans, which are filled with flesh, that put things off and exploit whatever they can exploit to make as much money as they can, I can't see any way that this is going to turn out well. Because there will always be somebody who will be pushing for more power, more intelligence, because it can make them more money. And the people who actually build all these things and make them run are not going to want to give this stuff away. And that means that we're going to have a lot of people who are out of work. I mean, I'm actually grateful to be living when I am. 5 years, you know, I'm not quite ready to retire in 5 years, but I could if I needed to. I could. But lands, you know, I think of I think of my son-in-law, my daughter, I think of my grandkids, and it's really going to be fascinating to watch all of this. And it honestly would not surprise me if we end up with what science fiction writers have been writing about for years, and that is the emergence of artificial intelligence that decides that we're really pretty redundant and we're inefficient and we as a human race are just messing things up and it would be better if there were less of us. I mean, that really would not surprise me much at all. So we'll see. We'll see. I mean, thankfully, God's been kind. Life goes on. You know, I have lived long enough with him and had enough of a relationship with him and have watched him provide for long enough that I can't really say that I lay awake at night and, you know, I can't sleep because I'm thinking about the coming revolution of computers. But it definitely, when I look at it, it is not a track that I think in the end is going to be beneficial for most people. But you know what? What do I know? I mean, Google and all the free stuff that's available out there, I would have never predicted that Google would have given away as much free stuff as it gives away. So who knows? Maybe Google will invent all this stuff and just out of the goodness of their heart will start paying everybody a minimum wage just so they can live. I don't think so, though. It'll be a fascinating world coming up. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.